This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene's Peaceful Independent Community Radio. All right, I have a long piece here by Josh Hernandez from the Anti-Capitalist Book Fair up in Corvallis a month ago. He's available on PM Press. He wrote the book. He's talking about his book and reading from his book, The Hands That Crafted the Bomb, The Making of a Lifelong Anti-Fascist. And that's, again, available on PM Press. Just a little explanation. Last week, you know, what this show is, what you're listening to, is a guy that goes out and records stuff that is not available anywhere else. And then I throw a few things in there, too, in addition to that. And so, you know, I throw this stuff together and I try to get it on the air as fast as I can. So that's why last week, I just want to clear up... Christiane Williams, there were several presentations at the Anti-Capitalist Book Fair, and so I could only go to one at a time. So I went to Christian's one on basically realism in comic books, and that's what you heard last week. But I didn't go to the one where he discussed violence at demonstrations and how to stop violence at demonstrations. So Josh Hernandez... I went to his, and again, he is someone who has pushed back against neo-Nazis using violence, and so that's what we talk about here, and I ask him some questions outside the lecture at the end. And yes, I kind of toned it down. I don't believe in violence myself, so but I totally respect those that do, and I believe in, now I believe in self-defense, and... Again, there's a parade, there's a demonstration, and then there's a protest. And we'd like children to be available in all those venues. And we'd like the neo-Nazis to stop coming to those venues and threatening the people there, the especially the LGBTQ people there. So that was a major subject of the Anti-Capitalist Book Fair. And then, again, this is Josh Hernandez, who has varying strategies that he has used over the years, and he's a teacher also against neo-Nazis. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. And, you know, please use your own brain and form your own opinion and all that, too, and research all this stuff yourself. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. Coming up, Josh Hernandez, The Hands That Crafted the Bomb, The Making of a Lifelong Anti-Fascist.
I think y'all have something really special here. I've been talking to a lot of people. Seems like there's a lot of unity and love here in this town. Is this true?
I think so.
Yeah, it seems like it.
Dreamy.
Yeah, dreamy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not like Sacramento. Sacramento is sort of a goal.
San Joaquin Valley.
There are, yeah, we have our share of dreamy people, but we have other people too. So yeah, this is great to be here. I've been talking about this book for the past, whenever it came out, I don't even know, but I've just been, last summer I drove with my son, who is 10, from Sacramento to New York and back, just doing readings from this book. It was really fun. PM Press has been great, a great publisher to work with. And they're going to publish the second part of this book in January 2027, called Letters to My FBI Agent. So this book is really just... I'm a college professor. I teach writing, and I teach at a school that is sort of like upper class, white, well-to-do, and when Trump first came into office, I had all these students who were like, we don't feel safe here anymore. Queer students, trans students, brown students, and they're like, what do we do? So I'm like, oh, my friend started this campus anti-fascist network. for college campus. It's like basically a club, right? You get together, talk about fascism, make flyers, make zines. Sometimes we'd go to protests. So it was great. The first meeting, there were about 60 students there. And I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. All these students wanted to come. And even students who were like conservative, they were like, what is this fascism thing, right? And they're like trying to come to our club or whatever. They really dropped out after about 2 days, but it was the thought that counts. So about a week after I started the club, I got a letter in the mail from my HR that said that I'm under investigation. So my work did this year-long investigation on me. And what they charged me with was taking students to protests and arming them with weapons. And I was like, what the f-? That's crazy. It's crazy. I can't even get them to do their homework. So anyway, it was a year long. It was a year of the investigator pulling students out of their classes, pulling staff and faculty out of classes, just to get dirt on me. After the year was over, the investigator determined that I didn't do shit, which was great. And so they had to grant me tenure after that, which was the best one. So, yeah, and it's crazy. So, like, almost everyone who was involved with that investigation is now gone, and I'm still there, which is hilarious. But it really is... So when I first got hired, I'm like, oh, I'm going into this progressive institution, right? Higher education. We always think that, don't we? Or I was like, oh, this progressive place, everyone's going to love each other. That's not what it is at all. It's a business, right? They run it like a business. And if it's not the bottom line, then you're there. So, like, they co-opt the language of progressive causes, right? And every day when I'm walking on campus, someone will say equity. Just, like, no context, it's like you have to say it. You have to say equity. You have to say diversity, right? When George Floyd was murdered at the hands of police, the administrators like turned their Instagrams black, right? And that was it. They didn't do anything else. But that was their statement. That was the thing they did. So like, it's very performative, right? And so when you step outside of that, it's a threat to the institution. So these are the things we have to think of as anti-fascists, right, who also have jobs and operate in the real world. Like, how do we do this? Do we just go full bore and steamroll over everything? Or do we play our cards? Do we sort of hold back at certain times? What do y'all think? That was actually a question. I don't know. I'm like full steam ahead. But it gets me in a lot of trouble. Like a lot of trouble. What about you all?
I'm a full-on fuck it person, but I think like what I'm thinking about right now is I think we need to be more strategic in how and when we use, you know, come to the streets or using different tactics.
Yes.
And I'm really interested in having conversations about that. You know, I've been organizing for 38 years, and I've seen changes, but nothing like this. And so that's what I guess I'm interested in. I'm also a professor. I've also been targeted.
Okay. Yeah.
So just sympathies and solidarity.
Yeah, absolutely. Although my job isn't hard. Like, I feel like I have a really easy job, so I don't really complain about it too much. So I'm going to read this story in here about the first time I found out about Anti-Racist Action, which was a group that started in the Midwest, trying to get neo-Nazi skinheads out of the scene, the punk scene. But the person who introduced me to that was Aragorn. And some of you may know Aragorn as the publisher of Little Black Cart, very controversial dude. A lot of people hated him because he like sometimes would like latch on to these very sketchy movements and platform like anarcho-nationalist like that. But anyway, he's dead now, so we don't have to worry about him. But before he died, he took me out to breakfast, and he's like, you gotta quit all this Antifa. And I'm like, what the f***, dude? You're the one who introduced me to this shit when I was 15. He's like, it's just it's a dumb band-aid that doesn't work, right? And that rubbed me the wrong way. Because it's not the only thing, right? Like, street action isn't the only thing. And I've seen it in here. Like, there's gardening, there's graphic design, there's poetry, there's literature, there's everything, right? So, like, I feel like we have to remember that there's a whole gamut of things we can do. And if we get too focused on the street violence or running Proud Boys out of town. Do you have Proud Boys here?
Not anymore. Because we ran them out of town.
Good. Yes. It's helpful. Right? It's helpful. It's helpful to do that. So it's like, but there's so much other shit. And so like, let me read this. I was 15 years old when I was introduced to anti-racist action. That was in 1990. I'm old as fuck. But it worked. There were so many boneheads who'd come to our shows, and we just accepted it because we were little kids, right? We're like, oh, we're just gonna try to stay away from them. But they were part of our scene. Like, when I look back at it, I'm like, what the f***? Why did we do that? And we did it for so long, but we had enough. Right? And we had all these zines. Aragorn brought us all these zines about anti-racist action. Hide weapons outside of shows. And it doesn't matter how small you are. If you have enough little kids with weapons, it's scary. Right? It worked. It worked. And the same thing. The neo-Nazis are gone. Right? They moved up to the hills. Which is amazing. I love that shit. So, I sold all out of my books last week in Las Vegas, and I guess PM sold out too, so there are no books. This is the only book that exists. So you can't get one. Alright. We marched along K Street in an unruly line. A bunch of angry 16-year-olds chanting out-of-sync rhymes and cracking voices. Rejects with up haircuts, trailed by a crowd of cops whose hands clutched their batons like beefy G.I. Joes. The Nazi skinheads seemed to be spawning, infesting all the punk shows, flaunting their swastika tattoos, flying Sieg Heils into the crowd of kids who were there to watch the bands and get rowdy in the pit. The Nazis were bigger than us and older. Nobody knew what to do. Any sign of opposition was met with a savage beating, a flurry of fists, and steel-toed boots delivered to the gut. There was a meeting hosted by Aragorn, an older college kid who had a way with words. He heard about a group in Minnesota called Anti-Racist Action, a bunch of kids, punks like us, who were dealing with the same Nazi problem. They went to shows together. They brought weapons. It was working. We can do it too if we're organized, Aragorn said. Aragorn was a loudmouth, a straight-edge kid who loved to cause trouble. He made long-winded flyers about the ills of drug use and posted them all over Sacramento. There were 10 of us at the meeting, held at Aragorn's tiny apartment in Midtown Sacramento. He had a pile of records as high as my head. He told us some Nazis were having a rally and we were going to do a counter-demonstration. None of us knew what that was, but we all nodded because it seemed right. On the day of the counter-protest, we marched. Some kids carried cans of spray paint and under the cloak of the crowd sprayed messages like racism and drew a big A with a circle around it on the sidewalk and windows of the businesses. Antifascista, we screamed as we marched. Out of nowhere, three bald heads appeared and we stopped, mouths agape. as if none of us actually realized who we were protesting. Actual people in uniform, with boots and braces and swastikas tatted in blue ink. They screamed white power and held their middle fingers up to the crowd. We watched them watching us, and the space separating us grew into its own city of volatile ideas. We had no weapons, no bats, knives, or sticks, only our voices, held like black flags under the California sun. I found a Coca-Cola in my backpack, 12 ounces of high fructose in a red can. It's elegantly sloped cursive, as iconic as the American flag, and I hurled it at the closest bonehead I saw. I remember my dad telling me that Coca-Cola was once considered a wonder tonic of cocaine and caffeine. It helped calm the souls of the terminally nervous. I laughed at the image of nervous old people jittering around the world, coked out of their goddamn minds. They probably thought they knew everything, even while slowly killing themselves one bottle at a time. I lobbed the can at the skinheads, and it sailed through the air like a little red fighter plane, crash-landing onto a Nazi's cheekbone and opening a gash the size of a fist, spilling blood and soaking his white t-shirt. The police froze in confusion while the bonehead wiped the blood. His red hands glowed under the sun, and he smiled, and he took a solid step toward us. But then his knees gave out, and he fell hard to the concrete. One of his friends rushed to help while the other launched a seagull high above his head. I half wondered if the guy seagulled whenever his reflexes were tested. Like at the general practitioner's office after the rubber mallet banged under his knees. The other bonehead ran off and disappeared behind the Bank of America. We cheered and laughed as the hurt Nazi tried to get up. I almost felt sorry for the guy, as he laid there, greasy and crumpled on the light rail tracks like a discarded bag of McDonald's. A woman from the street dropped her Macy's bag and wagged a finger in my direction. "Who are the real Nazis?" she said, and pointed to one of our anti-racist action banners. She turned to the police and demanded an arrest. But they were still frozen by idiocy and profusely sweating under their thick blue uniforms, all probably younger than I am today. When the sirens blared, we dropped our banners and took a hard left through the alley. The cops gave chase for a while, but quickly fizzled out, either unable to keep up or struck by boredom. Nobody went to jail. Our group met up later at a hardcore show in the basement of a rented house, where we circled the room like blood cells racing toward a fresh cut. The first band's singer wore a dog collar and screamed about chaos and destruction, and the room steamed and filled with the stench of angry adolescents stomping around endlessly, never tired of kicking and punching each other for fun. The show stopped short when a cruiser pulled up. Its familiar lights and orders barking from the megaphone gave us a thrill. We lived for the opposition. Once again, we scrambled out the back door, over the fence, and into the night, running and laughing and cursing like soldiers after a great bloody war. Aragorn got bigger and became a brawler, scuffling whenever he could. He shaved his head and wore combat boots. He became a sharp skinhead against racial prejudice, a group that opposed Nazis theoretically and physically. In the early 90s, Nazi skinheads were crashing every punk show, getting more brazen and stronger. If you wore a sharp patch, you were gonna fight. As Aragorn muscled up, I felt myself becoming smaller and weaker. Maybe it was the vegetarian diet. Maybe it was all the positive hardcore music I was listening to, as if Youth of Today and Bold was entering my bloodstream and sucking out all its nutrients. Whatever it was, I was on the sidelines for many fights. Maybe that was better. I wasn't disciplined. I didn't know what it would take to learn to fight or build my muscles. All I knew was that I hated those Nazi skins with all my soul, and I wanted them dead. I just wasn't ready to do it myself. One night in Sacramento, there was a show at the Cattle Club. Lots of sharps showed up, their bald heads sweating under the sweltering heat. New, different energy buzzed through the nightclub, something sinister. Enough bad energy to short out the sound system. It wasn't long before a group of Nazis showed up to find some sharps. Quickly after arriving, a Nazi pulled a knife and charged. Aragorn fumbled with a canister of mace and sprayed it into one of the Nazis' eyes. A fight broke out. the blinded Nazi wildly swinging his knife around. He stuck Aragorn in the kidney and spleen. Aragorn's roommate Paul, another sharp, tried to intervene, but the Nazi stabbed him once in the chest and again in the abdomen. Aragorn recovered in the hospital. Paul died the next day of stab wounds. It wasn't so foreign anymore, the violence, some abstract idea from a movie or television show. And it wasn't just relegated to my family. Death was everywhere now. So that was 1990 is when that happened. So that was a long time ago. So in 2021, there was a White Lives Matter demonstration at the park near my house. And I went with two friends, and we smashed it up, and I went to jail, which was fine. It was fine. I was only in there for 3 days. It was fine. But in the jail, the officer who arrested me alerted the FBI. So I have this tag on my file now that says I'm a left-wing terrorist. So I can no longer fly. And it makes my life very difficult. And so this FBI agent has been showing up to my house. He's been showing up to my work, and it's a nightmare. But anyway, the next book I'm writing, because the last time I talked to him, I'm like, dude, stop calling me. Never talking to you again. Get a real job. And he actually stopped calling me after that. But then I kind of felt bad for some reason. I don't know what's wrong with me. My empathy needs boundaries. I felt bad because I said, get a real job. No one wants to talk to a cop. He's like, really? I'm like, oh, okay. So anyway, I wrote a book. It's just a series of letters to this guy. And they're really funny. It's funny because his name was like Alan or something like that. But when he'd call my phone, his number came up as Maria Garcia. So the whole book, I just call him Maria Garcia. Because I know that's going to make him mad. That's like one of those things that's going to make a cop mad. I'm not Maria. Sacramento County Jail. So this is after I got arrested and they took us to jail. The SUV pulls into the carport that leads into the guts of the Sacramento County Jail. I've been in there a few times before, a fist fight, a few for public drunkenness. Nothing too serious, except for when I went to court thinking I had to deal with some tickets and the judge slapped me with an outstanding warrant. That time the bailiff handed me a stack of clothes and a towel and escorted me to a cell where I stayed for a couple weeks wondering what the fuck just happened. The cop driving us to the jail is a pudgy 30-something with dark brown hair styled into a razor-sharp side part, like he walked into the barber shop and asked for the Hitler. He parks, gets out, places his palm gently on my head, and pulls me out of this SUV. Then he does the same for Jose. We go through this set of double doors, and he asks me about my watch, a Garmin that I've just paid more than $1,000 for. It's a running watch, I say. You run a lot, he says? Yeah. Like, how much? I ran 100 miles this week, I say. I would have ran more, but you caught me. He doesn't laugh at my joke. The people I organize with tell me that I talk to cops too much. They're right. I shouldn't say anything. Even meaningless cops are vile, and they'll use any piece of information against me to expedite my legal damnation, but I can't help it. I love talking to people. My weakness is anyone asking a question. I would be a horrible superhero. What are you training for? I'm training for the Moab 240, the 240-mile race through Utah that should take about 4 days to complete. The idea is to run until you're too tired to run anymore. Then you take a little trail nap, and when you wake up, you run some more. It's a challenge of endurance and mental grit. The people who finish are the ones who can hold their pain in the palms of their hands and change it into something else, like magicians of suffering. I remember, though, that I should probably shut the fuck up. I'm not training for anything, I say, to appease my activist friends. The cop leads us to a booking room bustling with chaotic energy. We're herded around and told to sit on various benches as we wait to have our photos taken. I can see a side conversation between the cops speaking in hushed tones. Occasionally, one of them points at me. A steady flow of fresh prisoners stream into the room, all with horrible trauma written on their faces. I wonder if I look sad and beaten too. It's weird, I think, when humans do something bad and we're caught or put in a cage for a certain amount of time. It's kind of funny when you think about it, or maybe it's just sad. Finally, a beautiful Asian cop with CSI on her uniform tells me to stand in front of a wall and take off my shirt. I can't help but to notice how her boxy uniform is no match for her beauty. It's ridiculous to lust over a cop, especially one who is documenting all your tattoos so they can slap you with a gang enhancement. But goddamn if she doesn't look like a model. She uses this large camera hanging around her neck to snap photos of each of my tattoos. The one that says Lucifer across my stomach. The image of Satan burning down a church on my forearm. The one of a burning cop car on my calf. The black flag on my neck. The giant tattoo of two crossed obsidian knives with 161 and an Antifa flag under their handles. It takes a half hour to get through all my tattoos, while a crowd of cops stops to gawk like they've never seen a guy with tattoos before. After an hour, they lead Jose and me to the men's holding tank and drag TJ to the women's section. They take my anti-fascist action shirt as evidence, so I only have my bomber jacket on with nothing underneath. Jose is shirtless because they took his Brujeria's Matando Güeros shirt as evidence of him being a racist against white people. When we get in the holding tank, a dude looks at Jose and says, "Oh, you in here looking like brown Jesus?" And laughter rings out in the filthy, smelly cell. That's the weird thing about jail cells. Some of the best comedy is created there. Probably something to do with the bleakness of the situation, the confines, the bars, the lack of freedom that demands light among the darkness. One thing I've learned in jail is that some of the funniest people are also some of the most criminally mischievous. A few hours later, an officer opens the door and calls out our names, handing us a slip of paper with our charges. Felony conspiracy, felony robbery, battery, and misdemeanor hate crime. The bail is listed at $100,000. I can't understand how they give a hate crime charge to brown people for smacking up a couple of neo-Nazis. It seems like behavior that should win a community engagement award. I sit on the cold bench reading the sheet over and over again to see if I made a mistake, but all the charges are still there, so I panic a little and use the phone to call Crystal. And to my surprise, she answers. Her voice is calm. I can hear the kids in the background asking questions. A deep, sinking feeling in my heart settles into my soul. I want to go home, I think. I called Liliana, and they're working on it, she says. I love you. I love you, I say, and hang up the phone. I want to cry because I love you so much. I wonder if Liliana, our friend who runs an organization that bails activists and refugees out of detention, will help us. I wouldn't bail me out if I were her. The bail amount is 100 grand, but you only need 10% to get out. That's $10,000 for three of us, and that's a load of cash. I stand at the phone booth watching a buff Russian dude nodding out next to me. Jose is sitting on the bench trying to keep warm by hugging himself. All of this would be so hilarious, the soggy bread and spaghetti thrown by an agitated gangster across the tank in disgust, the piss I just took that lasted 5 whole minutes, Jose in the corner shirtless and shivering like brown Jesus caught in a snowstorm. But despite how funny this is, it's hard to laugh in such a filthy hole. After several hours, a bored cop hands us our bright orange jail scrubs, some towels, soap, and toothbrushes, and ushers us into another room. Well, they say it'll be a while until we go upstairs to ourselves. We all stake out spots on the benches to sleep, the heroin addicts getting the last dibs because they're so slow and confused. I sprawl out and close my eyes, trying to drift off under the bright lights and sound of various screams bouncing against the walls. I wake up with a kink in my neck and the sound of an officer telling us that we're going upstairs. It must be around midnight. We all get up, shake off the sleep, and follow him in a line to the elevator. Every now and then, someone gets yelled at for stepping in the wrong area. "Stay behind the f***ing line," the cop yells, with the boredom of someone who has to repeat the same thing 1,000 times a day. A white boy next to me with dirty blonde hair and a sudden reddened face seems to be coming off a heroin high. He's groaning and itching and holding his stomach. He looks miserable, like he's about to vomit and then die. A tattoo on his forearm reads 1488. A symbol for the 14 words, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children," with the 88 standing for Heil Hitler. Part of me hopes he drops dead right there so I can spit on his corpse. "Is that an Antifa tattoo?" a voice behind me calls as the elevator jerks upward. A shiver runs through my spine. I pretend not to hear. "Is that an Antifa tattoo?" the voice says again. I look back, it's the cop, our shepherd into the prison, a goofy-ass redhead with jowls. I raise my shoulders to indicate that I don't know what he's talking about. "Yep," he says, showing me his phone. He shoves the phone in my face so that I can see the Wikipedia page for Antifa, a picture of the flag tattooed on my head with the description, "Symbol commonly used by Antifa, depicting an anarchist flag overlaying a socialist flag based on the logo for German Antifa movement." "It is Antifa," he says proudly, like a fisherman who just caught a largemouth bass. This explains the extra attention at intake, the photos, the gawking. They finally caught one. We exit the elevator in a line and walk into the pod, where some flimsy blue mattresses are stacked in the corner. The cop tells us to grab a bed when he calls out pairs of names. The person he calls out will be our cellmate. He calls most of the names until he gets to Jose, who grabs a mattress and then heads to the door to wait for his cellmate. The next person called will be Jose's cellie. The cop looks up from his list of names. "So, like, do you think I'm a fascist?" "I don't know," I say. "Do you have a picture of Hitler hanging above your fireplace?" The cop laughs and shakes his head and then calls my name. I catch up to Jose and tell him we're cellies, and we laugh like we've just arrived at the worst summer camp in the history of the world. It's pitch black now, except for the lights of the construction site down below. Our cell looks over the north end of Sacramento, where unfinished high-rise buildings jut into the sky in an incomprehensible network of scaffolding, ropes, and wires. I wonder how anyone makes sense of assembling a skyscraper. The toilet paper in our holder in our house has been broken for months, and all I can do is stare at it, wondering if I have the skills to engineer its recovery. Construction workers don't get enough credit. I sit on the top bunk watching Jose cleaning the cell, wiping down a metal table, sweeping the floor with a makeshift broom crafted from a paper bag. He works as a janitor in a shopping mall and it shows. He's very good at his job. "Why did they put us together, I wonder? Did they know we got arrested together?" "I don't know," he says, scooping up a pile of dirt into the little trash can. "They're probably too stupid to notice," I say. "I gotta take a shit," Jose says. "But we don't have any toilet paper. We were supposed to take a roll of toilet paper from the pod, but we both forgot. So we ring the emergency bell for the cop. Nobody answers. Jose pounds on the door, but it's the middle of the night, and we're probably starting to annoy the other people in their cells. Jose will have to use the brown paper bag as toilet paper. He tears off a little square, takes his shit, wipes, and then crumples the soiled paper into the rest of the paper with paper bag pieces. We roll it up and throw it in the trash. When I finally lay on my bunk, all I can smell is in our little grime-colored cell and a trash can full of chunks. I pull the blanket over my head and start laughing like a little boy. "What?" Jose says. "We're in jail," I say, "and we're covered in shit." And we laugh uncontrollably. In the morning, I watch the workers taking the lift up and down the side of the structure, taking a break at the top of the building to eat sandwiches from their lunch boxes, the blazing sun getting hotter by the second. I have to break my vegan diet to eat some breakfast, rubbery eggs, flavorless oatmeal, canned fruit, and a puck of sausage. It's not the worst thing I've eaten, and there's something about it I enjoy, a meal I don't have to cook myself. I don't have to do any dishes. When I'm done, I just slide the tray through the metal slot in my door, and a fat cop takes it away. It's boring, though. The jail is on lockdown because of the pandemic, so we're left to entertain ourselves all day and night in our cell. Jose and I do a workout, some pull-ups, push-ups, and squats. We talk and fall asleep a few times until I hear Fernandez over the speaker in our cell. It must be my lawyer, I think. The door buzzes and I get out of the cell, but I don't know where to go. Jail is weird because everyone expects you to know what to do, but it's like setting foot into a new planet where everything is different and nothing makes sense. Add to that the fear of getting your ass beat by a cop, and you turn into a bumbling idiot. I ask a tall skinhead sweeping up the pod what I'm supposed to do, and he tells me to get out of the pod and go up to see my lawyer. I leave the pod and see a door that says enter, so I try to open it. Immediately, a booming voice tells me to go around the corner. I go around the corner to find a red-faced corrections officer in an office. He's unreasonably fat and out of breath, and he yells at me, "You are the stupidest mother I've ever seen," he screams. The more he looks at me, the angrier he gets. I'm pretty sure he wants to tear my face off with his teeth, but he's too big to get out of his chair and walk down the small flight of stairs from his booth to get me. Why? What did I do? "You don't ever try to open that door," he screams, pointing to the door I tried to open, the one that says enter in giant block letters. "Oh," I say, "I wasn't sure where to go." "You want to get shot?" he yells. "No." "You want to get killed?" "No." "I should break your ribs." "I'm just trying to figure out where my lawyer is." "She's up there, you stupid motherfucker," he says, pointing to a row of windows up a flight of stairs. I mean, yeah, it seems obvious when he points it out. I walk up the stairs and open a glass door and sit at the visiting window, where my lawyer Amy sits on the other end of the glass. She's an attorney for National Lawyers Guild. They represent activists who get caught up in the legal system. "Are you okay?" she asks. "Yeah, I'm fine. I think that cop down there wants to kill me." "They're assholes," she says, waving him off. She tells me that I'll probably be in jail for a few days as Liliana gets the bail money together, or if the DA drops the charges, which she thinks he might. She gives me some affirming words and tells me not to worry. I can't help it, though, because I'm already worried. I don't tell her that, though. I want to seem tough. I say goodbye, get up, and go back downstairs through the large metal door to our pod. The skinhead is still sweeping. "How'd it go?" he asks. "Not great," I say. "You're staying here a while?" he asks. "Nah," I said. "Not that. The guard down there was trying to murder me." "Oh," he says, "yeah." He continues sweeping. He's not doing it right. George, the owner of the apartment building, who taught me how to sweep, would have disapproved and maybe even yelled at him and snatched the broom. But I don't have the courage to say anything. So I continue up the stairs to our cell where Jose is doing pull-ups on the bottom bunk. I climb to the top bunk and watch the construction workers from the window. I imagine myself as one of them, standing on a plank seven stories up with a tool belt strapped to my waist, chugging an energy drink to stay alert enough not to plummet to my death, eyeing the clock for my lunch break. I can't tell which is worse, that life or this one. I decide life is whatever the hell you make of it, and curl up in my blanket. "Fernandez," the loudspeaker buzzes, cutting the day room in half. "Pack up, downstairs." "Downstairs," I think. "Isn't that where the violent offenders, gang members, and pedophiles go?" "What the fuck?" I said to Jose. He shrugs his shoulders. "I don't know." So they put me in the gang unit. So they took pictures of all my tattoos and determined I was in a gang. And I went to the gang unit. So that's why I have the FBI following me around. So be careful. So think about the tattoos you get. And if you ever get arrested, you're going to have a time in jail. You know, my friend Eric has that big Antifa tattoo up right on his, right? And he was in the Supermax. That's not fun. Can I read the end? I've never read the end. Can I read the end of this book? PM Press always tells me that. They're like, "Don't read the end, you kid." And I'm like, "Dude, why?" The end of this book, it doesn't really matter. It's not like a suspenseful book. The end of this book is really just, I got tenure, all the administrators who tried to fire me fell off. And they were pissed because I got tenure. And that was it. Now I'm just back teaching at the best community college in rich Folsom, California. So this is the last little bit of the book. I'll just read this and then we'll talk a little bit. It's called "There's a Brilliant Light After All This." The campus parking lot is nearly empty. Multi-million dollar homes resting on the skyline like judgmental gods, snickering at the simple community college folk limping toward the idea of a meager existence. The pandemic ripped through the education system, leaving a ghost town in its wake. Nobody wants to waste money on school anymore. Nobody wants to waste time on work. It's almost as if COVID tore off our decorative gowns and left us in the nude. We're all covering our bodies, wondering if everyone feels as awkward as we do, with our private parts slapping against our bodies in the wind. If the modern campus, with its sleek, angular design and drought-resistant landscaping, was sad before, its current iteration, a barren and overgrown manifestation of our two-year isolated existence, is its suicidal cousin. A sense of dread sets into my lungs and stomach as I walk across the lot toward the stairs that lead to my office. I wonder if my posters are still on the wall, or if a conservative student or the janitor who always looks at me sideways took a moment to rip them down in a fit of patriotic rage. To my surprise, almost everything is still attached to my door. The large "Fighting Fascism is Your Social Duty" poster, the "Anti-Fascism is Not a Crime" sticker, the infographic with the number to call if police show up at your doorstep. With only a few blank spots where someone must have seized a golden opportunity to peel away a sticker or two. I don't even remember what was in the empty spots, but I have hundreds more stickers, each more offensive than the next to the Republican sensibility. I try my key a few times, but it doesn't budge. They must have changed the locks. I head to the business office to get a new key and see the conservative janitor. He used to stand outside my office door reading my posters aloud in an angry tone. I sometimes thought I should open the door as fast as I could to scare the shit out of him, but I never did. I let him stand there reading my posters to himself. What to do when the police show up at your doorstep? Psh. Maybe he'd learn something. Probably not. Who gives it, really? But there he is, a gigantic man well over 6 feet, walking excitedly toward me, as if I'm his long-lost relative. They'll be right with you, he says. Thank you, I say. How are you? It's slow around here, he says. Either he's forgotten who I am, or doesn't care. Either way, I like the new relationship we have. Everything is different now. After George Floyd was suffocated by cops and the world erupted into riots that filled the streets with the flames of revolution, everything changed. Even our school went woke. The allegiance to the institution was replaced with an allegiance to anti-racism. The book circles about self-care and institutional effectiveness became anti-racist book circles. The clip art of cartoon pens and books turned into email signatures calling for anti-racist pedagogy. In official documents coming from our district, messages from higher-ups now suggest that faculty participate in anti-racist action and decolonization. You know what's crazy, though? That investigation that they put me through, one of the bullet points was he organizes with a group called Anti-Racist Action. It's like they forgot. They have no shame. Institutions are not your friends. They're not your friends. I want them to be. I wish higher education was my friend. Sad. What is survival for some is fashion for them. A trend that will one day go away. And it's already gone away, by the way. They don't give a fuck anymore. Now that everything is upside down, I am right side up. The administrators who tried to fire me for being part of a group called Anti-Racist Action never apologized for accusing me of terrorism. They nod and smile politely in the hallways as if nothing happened, unaware that they're burning themselves alive in the flames of hypocrisy. I wonder if they think to themselves, it's just business, just the nature of the institution. I wonder if they know that's why we'll do our best to tear it all down and replace it with something better. Something for actual people rather than just another conveyor belt full of bootlicking opportunists feeding the greedy mouth of the corporate world. We got new locks, the janitor says, as if he's trying to comfort me somehow. As if he's saying, don't worry, you still work here. He points me to a room where I can pick up a new key. I get my new office key and wander through the empty buildings, now and then passing a student with their head buried in their phone. There's a food truck in the quad, with a few students milling around, but I decide to hit the vending machine for chips and a soda. But to my surprise, it's out of service. The entire cafeteria is empty. What was once a bustling hub for student activity is now a sea of empty chairs and tables shining under the buzzing lights. It's like a post-apocalyptic movie. I look around the room for something sharp to steal, but there's nothing I could use to bludgeon a zombie back to death. I get to my classroom, and my students are lingering outside. It's the first time I've seen them in person, other than their profile pictures on our digital roster. "Hey, y'all," I say, and I open the door. They follow me sheepishly inside. The classroom is just as I remember it after 2 years, drab tan walls with brown carpet and unforgiving fluorescent lights, where not a single blemish escapes scrutiny. I am visibly older now, the laugh lines deep enough to qualify as wrinkles. My hair dyed half yellow is scraggly but hidden under a dad hat. None of it seems to matter anymore. There's sadness in my students' eyes, probably in mine too. This is where I'm supposed to be, I think to myself. A familiar warmth fills my body. My parents haven't talked to me in 2 months. It was the argument stemming from my son's blue hair. My mom couldn't get over it. She met us one day to look at the ducks in the pond and had anger written all over her face like a manifesto before a mass murderer wires up a van with explosives. She wouldn't say anything, so my stepdad did all the talking. The conversation was forgettable, about the ducks, about the weather. My kids were annoyed and tired. They wanted to go home. Luna started crying and kicking. We called it early and went home. The next day, I texted my stepdad. "Mom didn't look so good. Is she okay?" He replied, "She's fine, physically, but we should meet." We met up the day after at the coffee shop where my stepdad looked tense and concerned. I can still hear his voice as he looked up the rafters. "You're setting them up for disaster," he said, taking sips of his coffee from a large white mug. They think his blue hair symbolizes hatred, a feud to society, a black flag in the eternal war of social mores and good manners. But it's none of that. We want our children to grow up in a world of expression and freedom, where the moods can dictate the style and their style can dictate how they choose to move throughout the world. Hopefully with curiosity, kindness, love, and maybe even some well-placed rage. Their emotions will be theirs, and they won't be controlled, only nurtured and guided by parents who have made their fair share of mistakes, but want a good world full of good people. Did you even notice if your kids said hello and goodbye to their grandparents? He was talking about the duck pond when my mother wore a face of a madwoman, and my stepdad's tension cut through the gloomy day like a guillotine. "Not really," I say. "I don't notice these things. It's one of my weaknesses." "You see," he says, as if he's caught me once and for all, the final unforgivable act of bad parenting. My kids, Ezra and Luna, children of energy and light and pure chaos, have emerged from a 2-year pandemic just as lovely as they entered it, full of curiosity and wonder. We roll around the floor laughing until our throats are sore. We read under the lights. We purr with our cats until we're asleep under the glow of the television. To my parents, I'm a failure, a bad person, a loser, a madman, a savage. They watch my children as a prison guard watches the inmates with a cynical frown. I know they're destined for damnation. When I look at my students, I'm filled with unbelievable joy. They're the reason I started teaching, not the emails from administrators or the dead homework discussion boards of the pandemic. We talk like old friends about the past 2 years and tell stories of our adventures. A student is talking about her grandma and holding back tears. We're here with each other like nothing ever happened. "We should go to the food truck," I say. "Can we?" a student asks. "Yeah, why wouldn't we be able to?" "I don't know," the student says. "Aren't we supposed to be working?" "Yeah, but I didn't make a lesson plan." They laugh, but it's not a joke. I just didn't prepare for the day. I wanted to show up and see what happened. What if it was horrible? What if they were all boring? What if I had a panic attack? What if I ran to my car, skidded away, and never came back? Sometimes it's best to just take things as they come with no preparation. Let the world hit you in the face if it needs to. We leave the classroom and spread into the empty campus, filling it with life. The student is right, I think. We are in school and we should be working. But maybe this is the work. What we're doing, what this new world requires of us. First, we build community. Find the people who have the skills, the mass of people, to lift the heavy machinery, to untangle the mess of wires, to help you calm down, to help you focus on your breathing, to disassemble the technology, to pick up the right wire, to tell you that it's going to be okay, to hand you the scissors, to craft a story to dissect you as you snip the first wire, even if the story is not true, even if it's only going to get you from one wire to the next. To wait for the explosion, to realize that all these wires, the ones that others placed and the ones that we placed ourselves, can easily be pulled out and redirected, to exhale a collective sigh of relief when there isn't an explosion, only a brilliant light that overtakes everything we've ever known. That's the end. Now you don't have to read this book.
right, so you mentioned institutions, and you know the song Suicidal Tendencies about institutionalized. Aren't these people, and even the police, aren't they victims of a screwed up society? And is violence necessary? I mean, I'm into self-defense. I can understand self-defense, but and a little bit of vandalism, too. But
yeah,
aren't these people victims also?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent they are victims. I think everyone's a victim of the institutions. But that said, you have a choice, right? Like, you don't have to be a cop. You weren't born a cop, right? You weren't born a neo-Nazi skinhead. So, some of the things we did, and we've been doing is we will dox the living shit out of a neo-Nazi skinhead, right? We'll publish all their information. We'll publish their home address, we'll publish their work, we'll flyer their work, we'll flyer their neighborhood. And it's not worth it to them. So a lot of them will end up getting out of the movement if it's too much trouble.
So it works.
It works.
To push back.
It works. Yeah, it works. So like all kinds, and it's not just violence, right? So it's like doxing is a really good method, I think.
Well, I mean, I've said, and I'll wrap it up real quick, but I've said long ago that I used to think that we should just put them all on an island somewhere.
Yeah.
And but that doesn't work either, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
They're going to expand from there. So we can't just put them all on an island.
No, and I tend to believe that humans are pretty amazing, and humans have capacity to change.
Well, but I mean, so Nazi Germany, you know, the beer hall push, they said if it wasn't for the economic problem and that we screwed them up, you know, with the Versailles Treaty,
yeah,
that we probably would have laughed at Hitler,
right,
laughed him out of the beer hall.
Right.
So, A, what about that? And A, also B, what about laughter as an approach? Why shouldn't we just laugh at him?
Totally. Honestly, I always say that. Like, laughter is probably the best antidote to a lot of things.
Although we did jail solidarity for the trees, and we were laughing at the cops.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know Tim Ream, but he's a very big tree hugger person.
Okay.
He was telling us to laugh at them when they fingerprint us, because they went into this elaborate thing on fingerprinting, and they pulled him out and put him into solitary.
Oh, really?
You know? And yeah, so that the cops do not want you to laugh at them.
They do not. No. Yeah.
Well, so are they a lost cause though? Are skinheads
no.
a lost cause?
No. I don't think so.
Then what should be done? Is there a positive thing that we can do to stop racism and authoritarianism?
Like, I don't think...
You're a teacher, you know.
Yeah, so. I mean, honestly, a lot of my students, or not a lot, but a portion of my students are white nationalists. So, and I also teach in the prison system, where there are real white nationalists.
Well, so there's brain damage, too, in the prison system.
Absolutely, yeah. So, but it's like... when I go in there and teach, I don't teach a white nationalist. I just teach English, right? And every class, they're always so thankful that, like, oh, man, I never knew how to write an essay, right? And so, like, the material transcends whatever their bullshit ideology is. So no one's a lost cause, because I see it all the time. And, like, a lot of those prison Nazis don't even believe in their ideology. It's just a prison thing.
So if they had something else to do, maybe something. Well, I don't know who said it, but if you can't create, we tend to destroy.
Yeah.
And we're all cogs in a machine.
Absolutely.
So just then, when they create, that might help them stop from destroying.
Yeah, creation, definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
And, so what about giving them a, a decent house to live in and a, you know, well-paying job or not even a job, you know. Basic resources.
I mean, if we can fix capitalism, I think a lot of our problems will go away. I don't think our divide in the country will be here anymore. Right? Like, I think a lot of the hate-based arguments will kind of fizzle away.
And maybe Trump wouldn't have been elected.
Right.
Too, if...
Right. Right.
All right. Anything else you want to say?
No.
Thanks very much for your time and your great work.
You.